This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. I hope you are having a good afternoon, and I'm glad to have your company. Stay tuned. In the next half hour, WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini will detail the various efforts to restrict the carrying of weapons at future public demonstrations in the wake of violent rallies in Charlottesville. She'll also explore the severe teacher shortage in Virginia and explore possible solutions. And she finds out how Invisibilia's Lulu Miller is diving into Virginia's history of eugenics. And in his first report for WMRA, Mike Dolzer takes us on a tour of the tiny little museum that commemorates the incredible outsized life and deeds of American hero Harriet Tubman. But first, it was a week to look back at mistakes made and lessons learned from how officials at all levels in Charlottesville, at the University of Virginia, the city's police, and the state as well, prepared for and dealt with not only the huge public demonstration and violence of August 12th, but also other rallies earlier in the summer that raised questions of free speech, public safety, and the carrying of guns and other weapons in public. Former U.S. Attorney Tim Hafey delivered his report on the August 12th events in Charlottesville to City Council last Monday night, and he got an angry reaction from many in the audience. WMRA's Jordy Yeager has the story.
Every seat in council chambers was filled Monday night as Hafey presented his legal team's findings for more than 90 minutes. Charging the city $350,000, Hafey and his team interviewed more than 150 people over the last 3 months, compiling a 220-page report. It found multiple levels of city and state dysfunction, outlining a myriad of missteps ahead of the white nationalist rally in which dozens were injured and 3 people died. But members of the public said there was something missing from the report. Dr. Rick Turner, the former head of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, said he believes the race of the city's police chief, who is African American, played a role in why his orders were not followed by rank-and-file officers that day.
If the author of the report was a conscious black person, he couldn't miss the relevance of race in this context. Instead, this report never mentioned it. We live in a state of steadfast denial.
Hafey, however, said he found no evidence of race as a factor, but acknowledged,
I don't think that its absence from the report is some sort of subtle suggestion that it's irrelevant. It absolutely is relevant. It is a little bit beyond the scope of what I think we were asked to do.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
After Hafey's report in the public comment period, City Manager Maurice Jones announced an action plan which included the creation of an emergency management team, additional training for the police department, and support for an amendment to the state code that would allow local authorities to restrict the carrying of certain weapons and firearms during events. And that speaks to another major issue that is already being addressed in several ways. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini has this overview of those proposals.
One thing that comes up regularly in conversations about August 12th is the frightening display of heavy weaponry in the city streets that day. It was a wake-up call, and some citizens responded.
So I started up a petition asking the city of Charlottesville to prevent anyone from bringing weapons, guns, knives, sticks, to rallies in public places with public permits. And I have gotten no reply whatsoever regarding knives or sticks.
That's David Swanson, an author and anti-war activist from Charlottesville.
But there is a law that has a list of several cities and counties in Virginia where supposedly you are allowed to ban at least certain kinds of guns, and Richmond is on that list, and Charlottesville isn't. And this is what I've been told by folks here in Charlottesville and by our delegate in the government in Richmond, is that you have to be on that list.
To address this, Democratic House Minority Leader David Toscano is proposing changes during the next General Assembly session, starting in January.
Well, I predict that there will be many gun safety measures introduced in this General Assembly session. As to Charlottesville and Albemarle, we want to put in a bill that will allow us as a locality to regulate weapons in public spaces like 10 other localities are already allowed to do in Virginia.
At the last city council meeting, Lisa Robertson, chief deputy city attorney for Charlottesville, cited the example of a similar bill in Tennessee.
It's exactly what we need. Tennessee is a Dillon's Rule state. They are a state that allows open carry of weapons without a permit and concealed carry of firearms with a permit. They're very similar to us. And as of July 1st, they adopted the bill that allows localities the same authority as the governor has given state agencies at the local level to regulate these things in public spaces. What they've said is that if you have a large event that's taking place, for instance, in a park, if you take certain steps to manage the area and to control the entrances and to do searches of people on the way in and to post the area as being one that during that event you're not allowed to have firearms in that area, you can do things a certain way.
Well, I think a bill through the Virginia legislature that would make very clear that every locality has the right to ban weapons at its own discretion, I think would be an excellent step. The next step would be for the state of Virginia to ban or at least restrict weapons statewide.
While not about weapons specifically, there is now a state lawsuit against private militias. Philip Zelico, attorney and White Burkett Miller Professor of History at the University of Virginia, recalled a case that can provide a precedent for Charlottesville.
Because I remembered from my own experience in litigation against right-wing extremist groups in the 1980s back in Texas, that Texas, like most states, has laws that prohibit private armies. They prohibit paramilitary groups arming themselves and coming to political confrontations. They prohibit self-appointed peacekeepers. These are old laws. Some of them go back to the very founding of the Republic. So Virginia, like most states, also has these laws in the books.
Drawing from this, the City Council of Charlottesville joined the Georgetown Laws Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection in filing a state lawsuit asking, quote, to prohibit key Unite the Right organizers and an array of participating private paramilitary groups and their commanders from coming back to Virginia to conduct illegal paramilitary activity, end quote. But what about the Second Amendment? Here's Professor Zelico again.
Whatever you think about the right to bear arms for individual self-defense, this is not a right that then allows you to elbow aside the local sheriff and make yourself the sheriff of your county and organize 20 of your friends with assault weapons to set up a private militia. That's not what the Second Amendment was meant to protect. The Second Amendment explicitly says that militias are to be, quote, well-regulated, unquote, course, by the state. And by then, they meant that the individual states each had the job of keeping the peace and organizing the militias. If everybody could organize their own militias and everybody could organize their own police, democratic government would disappear.
Regarding the lawsuit, motions to dismiss are pending in the state court. As for the petition, David Swanson hasn't heard back from city council members, but he said he would check in with allies like the local Amnesty International or the Charlottesville Center for Peace and Justice to see how they could press city council to act. Indeed, Jason Kessler recently announced he applied to hold another rally to protest against government civil rights abuse at an anniversary rally in Emancipation Park on August 11 and 12 of next year.
Some experts say the teacher shortage in Virginia is now a crisis, and not only is there a downward trend in enrollment and teaching curriculums overall, but the lack of African Americans in that field is even more alarming at a time when diversity in classrooms is becoming increasingly necessary. Marguerite has this overview.
Crowded classrooms and less one-on-one attention for students, overworked teachers who also have to serve as social workers and psychologists, plus mountains of paperwork. The situation in Virginia schools has gotten worse.
I think we're approaching what we would call crisis proportions.
Stephen Staples is the state superintendent of public instruction at the Virginia Department of Education.
As of last year, there were over 1,000 vacant positions in October of the school year when obviously students were already back in school. So that's a pretty serious problem, I think, for all school divisions.
Mathematics, special education, and science are the areas with the most need. But the problem is reaching across the entire curriculum spectrum. That includes teaching jobs in elementary schools, which used to be the easier positions to fill. Part of the problem is a shrinking pool of teaching students in the pipeline.
To make problems worse, since 2008, there's been a drop of 30% in the number of college students enrolling in teacher preparation programs in the Commonwealth.
That's Jim Livingston, president of the Virginia Education Association.
What's happening is our teacher pipeline is literally drying up at a time when we are seeing a spike in retirements.
Everyone agrees on a number of factors. There is pay.
Currently, at the end of last year, Virginia now ranks 32nd in average teacher salary, almost $10,000 behind the national average.
There's the cost of training.
Many universities ended up moving to a five-year program where students would need to stay to get a master's in order to get licensed, not what had previously been an undergraduate. And what we're hearing from some colleges and universities is that kids were willing to stay and get a four-year degree and come out and teach, but that fifth year was costly, and they thought that impacted it.
Also, the profession has lost respect over the years.
I can talk with older mentors in the community who can tell me stories about when they were growing up, teachers were kind of on the same level as doctors and lawyers, and now teaching doesn't get that same respect.
That's Tamara Diaz, a former Spanish teacher. She is now the executive director of African American Teaching Fellows, an organization in Charlottesville working to develop and retain African American teachers to support the schools in Albemarle County and Charlottesville City. She mentions another factor, the high test requirements to become a teacher in Virginia.
I've had colleagues that wanted to be teachers and are now teachers in North Carolina or they're teachers in Maryland because of one test or one score. I also have teachers who I'm friends with in Virginia who took a test four times. And so you're thinking about paying $100+ four times just to become a teacher in a field where you already don't make a lot of money. So,
House Delegate David Toscano says he is well aware of the issue.
In this next budget, I think the governor will have more money for teachers, and I'm going to be fully supportive of that. And we'll try to be working on some new regulations that will make it easier for teachers to want to stay in the profession. We can pass some laws to do that, and we can pass some budgetary amendments that will change the salary schedule for teachers.
But there's something else. Parallel to the general trend, African American students are even less likely to enroll in teacher preparation programs.
I have other students who would say, I'm a first generation college student and I have to make it and I have to be able to come back and help my family. I can't help my family on a teaching salary.
According to the Virginia Department of Education, nearly half of students in public Virginia schools are minority students, while only 16% of teachers are non-white. In Albemarle County, a third of the student body is non-white, but only 8% of their teachers are non-white. And Diaz says that's important.
For the nation to be so diverse, for this to be such a diverse community, and to have students say that I've never had a teacher who looks like me, that is impactful.
So what can be done? Statewide measures could encourage more student teachers, whether it be in the form of grants, by taking down some barriers to licensure through loan forgiveness, or reverting to an undergraduate degree.
I think you'll see some of those percolating through policy decisions, either on the General Assembly side or the State Board of Education side over the next few months.
As for teachers of color, the Virginia Department of Education partnered with the Virginia Education Association to set up a Virginia Minority Educator Recruitment Summit back in February. Another one is planned for the spring.
We actually offered six of our fellows a chance. We took them down to Richmond for the Teachers of Color Summit. A lot of our fellows, because we're still trying to increase diversity, they are the only or they're one of two or three teachers of color or African American teachers in their schools. So for them to attend a professional conference where they could meet other teachers of color was a great opportunity. They kind of got to see role models because they saw people who were in their 40s, 50s, 60s and in education. So for them, they could see, this is what I could do in 15 years or 20 years. Here's how I could still impact education.
Now, there's a lot more on that story through the links that we posted at WMRA.org. Well, now for some uncomfortable history. Lulu Miller, former Radio Lab producer and co-founder and co-host of Invisibilia on NPR, is now a fellow at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. She's working on a book called Why Fish Don't Exist, looking at how we categorize the world. One of the ways that officials as recently as the 20th century categorized people and acted on that was the not-so-old practice of eugenics. And Marguerite has that story.
In the 20th century, eugenics included the forced sterilization of people deemed unfit by the state, which could mean mental illness, but also promiscuity, homosexuality, or even swearing. It was legalized after a Supreme Court ruling following a case in Virginia in the 1930s and has never been overturned since. Lulu Miller recounts how Mark Bold, while he was a law student at Liberty University, started asking questions about this law.
And what everybody told him was that it was actually technically in this weird purgatory where it's legal at the constitutional level, never been overturned, but on the state-by-state basis, every single state had repealed it. So, you couldn't really get sterilized because if it's not legal at your state, you know.
But he dug further, and then he saw it wasn't really dead, like in West Virginia, for instance. Notes that this happened in 2010.
He wondered if that might be one of these weird arcane laws that no one actually obeys. So he decided that he would call the circuit clerk's office in Charleston, West Virginia. And he pretended, he invented a fictional daughter who was 22 years old, so above the age of 21. And he imagined that she was promiscuous and that she had intellectual disabilities. And he took a deep breath and he called them up and he said he was the father wanting to get her sterilized.
The clerk on the other end of the phone said that he just had to file a motion for sterilization and that the judge would most likely agree to it because, in her words, they know it needs to be done.
He was just shocked and chilled by her tone, just how regular it was.
Mark Bold now runs the Justice for Sterilization Victims Project. Today, many victims are still living. The state of Virginia officially apologized to the victims in 2002, and in 2015, the General Assembly set aside $25,000 for each of them. For WMRA News, I'm Marguerite Gallerini.
On an out-of-the-way street corner in Harrisonburg, a tiny building commemorates a legend of American history and represents the struggle to heal the nation's racial divide. WMRA's Mike Dolzer reports.
When you walk into the Harriet Tubman Cultural Center on Lucy Drive, you realize just how much history can be crammed into a tiny space, even if it's the size of a one-car garage.
This building may be little, but it's got a lot of power packed in it.
The center is filled with images of Tubman, posters depicting slavery, and it even includes a video about Southern plantation life. Owner and founder Stan Macklin provides tours by appointment for people who want to learn more about the abolitionist, humanitarian, and U.S. Army spy. Macklin opened the center in March 2010 as a means of keeping Tubman's legacy alive. He works with more than 30 other members, many of whom are his family members, to plan future projects for the center. He describes the center as a ministry, business venture, and cultural learning center with the aim of educating others about the ugly scars of America's origins.
America's original sin is that America was founded as a white society upon the near genocide of one race and enslavement and kidnap of another.
Macklin was also one of the proponents of the renaming of Cantrell Avenue to Martin Luther King Jr. Way, which was approved by the Harrisonburg City Council in 2013. Macklin also teaches a class in conjunction with the Commonwealth's attorney at the Harrisonburg-Rockingham County Jail. The class focuses on empowerment and reentry after incarceration.
We try to help people where we can to realize that they can make a difference in their life and in society.
Macklin sees some troubling parallels between modern-day jails and the system of slavery.
Slavery confined people who were basically brought here for economic purposes, and incarceration is the same situation. It's become a business, the business of warehousing the mentally ill and the addicted.
Macklin has also been disturbed by the political climate lately and seeing old wounds of racism get torn open again, most notably in Charlottesville in August. Macklin attributes the violence to people getting heritage and history mixed up with hatred, and has noticed some of that hatred make its way to his center, as some people have vandalized the property.
Broken glass and came in the parking lot, done things that is an ongoing process to the extent where I'm forced to get security cameras.
Aside from the vandalism and theft, the center has also been beleaguered by construction problems. The center was in the back of a brick office complex on North High Street until late last year when Macklin got some news.
The owner came and said that we have a month to vacate because he sold the building, which forced me to have to look for a new location and facility. I immediately went into prayer. I did not know where to go.
Macklin eventually found the current Lucy Drive location, but has still encountered problems with construction, with the land being developed for potential commercial property.
I feel like my life is under construction. Literally, we were aware that they were going to do some road construction and just take some of the yardage, but I didn't know it was going to be to this degree.
Despite the noise and disruption, Macklin is still keeping the center thriving and expanding. He plans to add outdoor exhibits, including a slave auction block, and is seeking new members to join him and the others as they fight to remember the legacy of Harriet Tubman.
I'm a firm believer that good will always overcome evil and love will always overcome hate. That's what Harriet Tubman done, and that's what I'm committed and dedicated to do as long as I have breath in my body. And so I want to spend my legacy challenging and raising up and empowering others to do likewise.
For WMRA News, I'm Mike Dolzer.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. When astronomers announced a new exoplanet in November 2017, what was the big deal? Well, for one, this planet is only about 11 light years away. That makes it the second closest exoplanet to us. But more than that, there's also very good evidence to suggest that this planet is small and rocky like our home and may have a balmy surface temperature also like Earth. Have we found Earth 2.0 right in our backyard? Does it have an atmosphere and oceans like Earth? Does it host life? It's these two questions that make Ross 128b an incredibly exciting discovery. The star Ross 128b orbits is not like our sun. It's a red dwarf star, meaning it's much smaller and cooler than our sun. That's important because this exoplanet whizzes around its star about every 10 days. Imagine living on this planet. You'd celebrate your birthday every 10 days. Now that's a lot of cake. Even though its year is very short, that its star is much smaller and cooler than ours implies that this planet is likely to have a conducive surface temperature for life as we know it. That makes this system a very exciting one to study for biomarkers moving forward.
I am Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bib and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Blind May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Jenna Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to support our news coverage, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news. Then click on News and Information Fund. All our stories are archived at that website. And be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. And here's a great way to keep up with local and statewide news each day with WMRA. Subscribe to our daily news podcast. It's called the WMRA Daily. Just look for the WMRA black coffee mug with a yellow sticky note that says daily. WMRA.org. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.